So, welcome to today's compiler construction. Last time we had the topic of analyzing a semantic property of code. Specifically, we were talking about the declaration usage analysis. And this time we're gonna delve even more into the topic of declaration of variables and occurrences of variables, in the sense that we now pursue the goal of having type-safe programs. And that is what type checking is all about. So, in the C-like family of languages, you find declarations of variables, where variables are associated with some kind of fixed type. You know the usual suspects. You have this base data types like int. You can have types that are constructed from others. Like, for example, here you get a pointer to a basic type, and you can even compose them to have some kind of tuple of types in this form of a struct, where the type is then comprised of two integers, x and y, for example. You need those things. Why do you need that? For once, you need to prepare memory area large enough to cope with all the values that are to be expected during runtime. Also, you want to have another layer of safety, in the sense that you don't reject only syntactically faulty programs, but also programs that don't have correct expressions in the sense of typing rules. And this will all in all help with trying to make sure that there's less runtime errors than in languages where there's no such strict typing rules. Yeah. In these languages, you declare a variable with a specific type, and the compiler then checks at all the usages of a variable, whether the variable is used in a correct way with respect to the declared type. So, if we talk about types, we need to talk about the kind of sub-language that introduces these types, and they form a specific kind of expressions called the type expressions, and there you have the kind of only base types that cannot be subdivided any further. Those are these famous things like int, character, floats, void, or whatever. These are your base types in your language. And then there's languages that are there for composing other types, called the type constructors. For example, if you look at something like C, you get the so-called structures, which are introduced with keyword struct, and then a sequence of declarations that are then the fields or the attributes or whatever you might want to call them of that specific struct. They once again are composed in a similar way as the usual declarations are. They have their own type expressions, and their names that are used to access these subcomponents of the composed type, thus also called the accessors of such a struct. Then what we already also had was this notion of pointers. So you can make a particular type T into a pointer to type T by using this type constructor star. You can also have arrays of things, in which case you would use the type constructor with the brackets in order to create an array of type that is prepending this expression. You, in some versions of the language, you can specify the size of an array as part of its type, and some you do not. In cases that you can do so, you would have to put the number of cells of your array into the brackets. And then, finally, there's the function type, where you have a type and then brackets with the parameter types. And if you declare a function like that, you would have to put the name between the return type, which is this singular type in the beginning, and the parameter types. So now to the problem of type checking. What is it all about? What you get given is a set gamma of type expressions, and each of these, well, not type expressions, type declarations, which consist of a type expression and a name each. And the question is whether an expression can be given a certain type T, and you're to solve that. For example, you could imagine an environment gamma to look like this sequence of type declarations. There's a struct called list. There's a function called f. There's another struct that has a certain name b, and then there's some array a, and all that. And the expression in question would be the one at the bottom over here. This complicated thing. What is the type associated with something like that? And well, all in all, at the compiler's perspective, you get given that kind of expression in the form of the syntax tree. So it looks like that. That makes it more clear what the nesting of the particular operators actually is. And the first idea would be to go through that syntax tree bottom up. Bottoms where all the leaves are, so that you get a grasp on all the low-hanging fruits in terms of types, in the sense that you can obtain the type of a constant quite easily, and also for a variable you might just want to look it up in the type environment gamma, and with that you already get your initial things with which you can then propagate types through the tree. So for each identifier that you have in such a system, you would look at type in the environment and constants. Well, you get them already kind of pre-typed from the scanner, and you can obtain such a type in there. And the question is now, what do you do with the inner nodes? And for those, we have special typing rules in languages that determine how the types are modified, or even which one of them is taken, or whatever is necessary at the particular node. Was there? Did I miss? No, didn't miss anything. Good. So in the in that sense, there's certain rules for type systems that have that we can apply here in this areas. So there's the axioms, which correspond to the leaves in the syntax tree. So there you can see how constants are handled. So given an environment gamma, a constant C is considered to imply a certain type for C. So it's associated with a certain type of C. And, well, that is not dependent on anything else. That's just depending on the constant itself. For the variables, we have something more elaborate. For if we encounter variable x, then we look the type for variable x up in the environment gamma. Those are the basic axioms. They don't have any preconditions. They just valid all the time. Then there's the rules, which are like the basic blocks with which you can compose more difficult expressions. So there's, for example, the rule that is used for creating a reference to a specific expression. That would be this one over here. And it would say, given that an expression E has type T, then the expression of this address of operator of the expression E would have to be read as would have to be associated with the type that E had as its pointer variant. So it's pointer to type T in this expression. In a similar way, you would go the other way around in case that you have this dereferentiation expression. That would be this one over here. Here you would decompose an expression that has this dereferentiation operator by under the precondition that E, the sub-expression E, has the type pointer to T, then the type of the dereferentiation expression is this T type. And in a similar fashion, you go through all the expressions that you might encounter in your syntax tree of the expression and set up more rules that need to be valid. So, for example, in the case of arrays, in order for the type T to be the valid type for the expression E1 with E2 as an index, what needs to be the precondition for that? Well, for once, we need E2 to be an integer. So that is introducing kind of a fixed precondition on this one. Or, and the expression E1 must be typed as pointer to type T. If that is the case, then T is the type of the composed expression. In the context of arrays, you can have whatever. So in the context of arrays, you can have also other preconditions. So it doesn't necessarily need to be that E1 is of the type pointer to a certain type, but it might also be just array type of some base type. And then what's happening here? Pretty sensitive thing. Okay. So you get also that as a possible rule that you could apply in that context. And there's even another one that's out there in implementations of C. I don't know whether you're aware of something like that. I didn't put it on the list here. Might, for example, also swap those two. You can also have the index first and then the array for whatever reason, I don't know. But that seems to be valid C. Yeah, then there's the structs. And they become interesting as soon as you try to access one of the fields. So you've got this accessing expression with the accessor AI on expression E, and that turns out to be of type TI if precondition E needs to be of a struct type, and even more, it can have an arbitrary number of fields. That's that doesn't matter, but what matters is there needs to be an accessor AI in there somewhere, and this accessor AI needs to have type TI. Well, it gets a little bit lost in this enumeration style here of having those little dots there, but what you would have to have is that, well, yeah, this AI would need to be found somewhere in the accessors of the struct. So that's basically what you need for that thing. Then there's the application of a function. So the expression looks like that over here. And when is that valid, or how does that relate to types? Well, first of all, it depends on E being typed as a function. So that is this over here. Then it needs to be typed in a manner that there's m number of variables, m number of parameters there, which is the same m as actual parameters that we find in the expression. And for each of those actual parameters, the type of each of them must be the same as the type that is used here for declaration of the function parameter. At least for now. Let's see how that develops. Then there's an application of an operator. In that case, I've put plus in there, but it might be any other old operator that you find within such a language. So it's E1 plus E2. And that is defined for int. So this will always yield int, but requires that E1 is of type int and E2 is of type int. At least for now. Then there's the notion of explicit casts. Looks like the expression over here, where you have an actual type in brackets and then followed by expression E, and that is translated into the preconditions that E must have some type T1, and for this type it needs to be valid that T1 can be converted to T2, whatever that means in terms of types. We are not so sure yet, but we'll see later on a little bit better what that means. But there needs to be some notion of one type to be convertible into another type. So in the example of type checking, this will, once successfully applied, lead to a whole lot of types being inserted into the leaves, where they, as an axiom, are just looked up in the type environment and then propagated through the whole tree until we reach the node that represents the complete expression. However, this is a little bit rushing through the complete process, because there's still a little bit of things hidden in there that are not so easily observable when we just have a look in the tree site. So let's look at the more formal process of the whole thing. So there you will see where the actual type checking is happening in that system. So for that approach, what we would do is we would start with the expression in question, which would be this one, and would put it in the target of all the as a target of a rule system, and try to decompose it rule by rule application until we reach basic axioms for each of the preconditions. So our goal is to ask whether type environment gamma yields for this complicated expression. Thus, we first start with the dominating expression in there, which would be the operator application. So we look up the rule for operator, and it says, well, we need to check preconditions for the left operand and the right operand. So we introduce them as these expressions over here, and recursively try to find rules that match these things. So for the right operand, we immediately need to refrain from touching the whole table. So that is already matching one of these basic rules, one of the axioms, for constant in that case. So we will quite easily fill that in the next phase. But the more complicated one is the left operand, which still needs to be decomposed. The primary thing to look at here is dereferentiation operator. Oh yeah, it's already mentioned here, the dereferentiation operator. And that has has certain preconditions on the operand, like here, and that's still a composed one. So we decompose even more. We have an array application here that imposes a precondition on A and precondition on the index expression over here, which itself is once again composed as an application, which then has also two preconditions for the expression that is on which it's called, and then there's the parameters, which is this arrow is just an abbreviation of this dereferentiation and accessor thing. So we do this accessor thing, dereferentiation, and the actual we end up with only one thing left here. And now that we have decompose the whole expression, we now try to look up the values, or depending on whatever we have found as axioms, we might just read off their type when it's constant. So maybe let's start with this variable thing here and look it up in the type environment. For B, we have a type struct like this. It's even pointed to a struct. So that is what we get from looking the whole thing up. With that, now we can determine the type that is yielded by the dereferentiation of the whole thing, which is then just the plain struct without the pointer to. And then in such a thing, we can perform the accessor. So now we can actually check whether such a thing exists in there, and it actually does. So in that sense, here is already the first type check that has been passed. So we have actually verified that there is an accessor of name C in there, and we could obtain a type for that thing. That now can be propagated because I ran out of space and had to rearrange everything, can propagate it over there, which is just the same type expression that we... And it seems that I even ran out of space anyway, so yeah. But it's still this struct list pointer that's over there. And before, remember, we had a quite complicated condition over here where this type needed to be the same type as this type over here because we had the application of a function. So now that we have filled in what the type for that expression over here is, we can now add that to the variable lookup as a kind of a requirement, and if we look up f, we see that it's actually declared as a function returning integer and taking struct list pointers. So here we get the next type check that we passed, and now we can also read off what the return value of the function actually is. So that was this int thing, which we needed exactly to hold because, well, we are here in this array index part of the expression where we needed the type to actually be int. So that was apart from the check from above here and this other check here, the third check that we passed while going through the whole system. So that was another type check. Then we can look up the type for A, which is just int pointer, which is also somehow some kind of check, as it needs to be an array type over here. So we obtain the integer pointer as the type of that thing, which we propagate over there to the dereferentiation. There we obtain int as the correct type, and then we only need to make sure that the constant is also of the right type, and with that we get that the whole thing is of type int. So that is what actually happens in there. So there's a lot of checks that are done during that way, and if you want to have a type system that is actually informative in some way, you need to perform all these things, and with this structure view you can pinpoint the exact sub expression that is yielding the type error. So yeah, that is what you would do in there. Apart from the expressions that that you find in your program, where you do these types of these rule systems where you set up your rules, how types need to work with each other. You often work with the notion of, well, one type must be the same as the other type, which leads to this question of equality of types. There's later on even some kind of notion of convertible types, where you convert one type into another or so. So these are certain properties of types that we need to talk about. In C, for example, it is solved in a way you expect types to be equal only in cases where, well, for the basic types it's quite clear, for the composed types it's mostly clear, with maybe one exception. The structs, there you have kind of different ways of how to interpret them. In C, you are bound to the notion of two structs, struct types being the same types if they are labeled with the same identifier. Thus, referring to the same declared type, so to say. So, if you set up two structs in C that have the exact same accessors with the exact same types, they are still considered to be not the same types. Only if they if the typing gives you that it's actually called the same, then they are assumed to be the same. So that is something that you can achieve by giving structs direct names with the identifier directly behind the struct, or even by issuing something like a type def. But there's other languages out there that mostly also use the C syntax, which have a different notion of type equality, namely structural type equality, which is, you should keep that in mind if you ever try to code C again. That's something that does not hold in C, but there's other languages out there that that have such a feature. So, what is all the fuss about structural type equality? You treat two types as even if all the accessor paths that you can apply on them yield the same values, or in the sense that the they accept the same set of access paths. What would be an example for that? For example, in recursive definition of a list, where you have next pointer to a list of the same type accessible under next. In structural type equality, you would consider another declaration where you have as a type for the next pointer here struct that is supporting the same accessors as the original, then you could have the same accessor paths in there. Both can access next.info, and both would be fine. So in the sense of structural type equality, if also the types of all these accessor paths are turning out to be the same, then they are considered to be equal types. And you could then use such a property for assigning one a variable of type to of type A to variable of type B, if they are structurally equivalent. The question is now, how do you actually do that? For the C version of equality of types, it was quite clear. You could just check the label with which you labeled each of the structs for whether they are the same or not, and if not, you could just reject. Structural equality is a little bit more work to deal to do. So, what would be a suitable approach to that? What we would want to do is we would track accessor paths through type expressions in the sense of as queries on the types, and as soon as two types that we get for each of these accessors are actually syntactically equal, we can stop to check that that thing. Otherwise, we would decompose the type expression and try to match each of the components, which would then hopefully be simpler type expressions to test for equality. And so let's introduce the kind of the standard that for recursive types, whenever we want to mention the type that we're actually already or in at that moment, we have something prepared as a type def for a certain type. So, in such a case, we would try to set up the tracking of the accessor paths in in certain ways. So, in case that we find the exactly matching syntax of types on type 1 and type 2, then we would consider this query as being valid. That is structurally equivalent types, definitely, because they are matching in their actual syntax. Then there's the ones which we have to decompose. So there's this pointer to a certain type expression, and in case that we have a pointer to an expression on one side and a pointer to is and then some other type expression on the other side, we would continue with exploring the equality of the types S and T, for example. Then if we encounter some type that turns out to be a type definition, then we would just inline the actual type. So instead of comparing the type definition variable A with some type T, we would continue with comparing the original type S and T. Then there's the notion of structs. And well, in these systems, we wanted to compare all the access paths in these types. So that's what we do then. We set up more accessor paths to follow in that manner. And if we have m many accessors within a struct, we would set up m many new accessor paths to track, and each of them would have to compare the types taken from both of the structs, like this one here, comparing those types, for example. So you set up m pairs of types to compare, and they are then once again smaller types than before. So, in an example, let's have a type A and a type B, and type A is a struct with info and next, and the other type B is also having field info, but on the next we have now this elaborate struct that itself also has an info and a next, which is the example that we used for introducing these structurally equivalent types. So the question in such a system would now be, is type A actually the same as type B, or if we already inline type A, is struct info next the same as the type B? And for that we would construct this deduction tree and start using our rules. We said that for type variables we would inline the actual types. So we would insert B here, and due to space reasons we have this abbreviated version with the dot 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 here, but that would actually be this thing with, in the dots. Yeah, those need to be compared. So what is the deal with structs if we compare them structurally? Well, we pursue the accessors, that is accessor info, and that is accessor next over here. Info leads us to the types int int, which is then already syntactically equal, so here we can terminate the deduction tree. On the other hand, we have pointer to A, as well as pointer to this complicated substruct. And first of all, we can remove the pointer to. Then we end up with A and our substruct. And we just inline A once again. So we have expanded to two structs, for which we once again explore all the accessors that we have in there. So there's the info accessor, which leads to closing that branch of the thing, and the other one is the next thing, which then leads to pointer to A and a pointer to B. First of all, remove the pointers, and then we obtain once again the initial query that we had for equality. That is the same thing as the one that that we have started with. So by going through all the accessor paths in there, all that we could find was that the types are actually matching, and the only thing which we didn't continue was one thing, was our exact beginning query, the one with which we started. And since we didn't hit anything else, this initial query didn't seem to find any evidence that there's some kind of type error in there. So we assume the initial equality as being actually valid. So there's no contradiction found in there. So the implementation for our structural type equality is then, if you can't find any applicable deduction rule in a certain node of this deduction tree, then two types are considered to be not equal, or a contradiction to the original assumption, so to say. If we expand a type definition, we might end up with a potentially larger type, but there's a chance for success still in case that an equivalence query appears a second time in our tree. Then we can assume that to be covered by the first occurrence in our tree already, and we say we don't need to continue proving equivalence anymore. We chain that to the original query for equality. And when we don't hit any contradiction, then everything turns out to be fine and it's equal by definition. So, question would be, is this ladder system that actually terminates? And the thing is that you can argue with the number of declared types that you find in a program, which is a finite resource, and there's only a finite number of equivalence queries that you can build with a finite number of occurring or declared types in there, and the repeated queries for the same inputs are already automatically satisfied. So in the end, we get that the whole system terminates at some point. So that is all fine, but still a little bit on the weak part of types, because what we didn't talk about so far is the notion of overloading of operators, for example. So you all might know these C behaviors as operators like plus are actually overloaded in several possible types. For example, you can interpret the addition operator as operating on ints. You can have it overloaded to being defined on floats. You can have it on being declared on pointers to ints, pointers to floats, and so on. So there's different notions of how to interpret certain operators depending on the actual types that you found in the program. And depending on the machine model which you have, on which you want to create code, it's actually important to find out about what kind of operation actually was meant originally by the programmer. So it is so you can generate the correct code that interprets the types correctly. There might be different additions for floating points and different additions for integers on your machine. So it's actually quite important to have the types that are involved in such systems. Good. What's out there that makes the whole thing even more complicated is something that's called coercion, which will allow the application of the operator plus, for example, or any other of those basic arithmetic operators to actually different types. So there's type int and float, for example, on which you can apply the plus. So instead of having actual different declarations of the operators that support for all the combinations of types that you could have, what is instead done is that the arguments for the operators are type coerced in some way. So, for example, if you have a type expression like this one, what you will get is that the whole thing will coerce to float type, since floats can cover all the integers, or at least it's assumed so, and then the operator turns into the operator for float, and the integer is converted into a float before the actual thing is happening. So this the coercion might actually need to generate code, implicit casts, for example, from integer to float or something. This thing already paves the way for the notion of subtypes out there, which is kind of the more general notion of what we have talked about before with ints and floats. So, subtypes. There is a hierarchy on the basic types already, which is already something like subtype hierarchy. So between characters, integers, long, etc., there is a hierarchy. And you can compare them for subtyping in a certain sense. So we define the subtyping between values of certain types in the sense that T1 is a subtype of T2, or T1 is smaller or equal than T2. That means that the values of T1 are contained in the type T2, so they are a subset of all the values of type T2 for once. Also, T1 typed values can be converted into T2 typed values. T1 typed values fulfill all the requirements of a type 2, so everything that you can do to T2 typed variables can be applied to values of type T1 also. And even better, values of type T1 can be assigned to variables of type T2, which is important in the context of these assigned expressions in there. So that is something that we have left out in our expressions before. But yeah, this notion becomes quite important in assignments. So assignable is a desirable property to be decided or not. So where it is really important is once again here these assignments, and what you want to have your system behave like is that if you have an assignment from X to Y, you need X to be assignable to T2 and assignable to Y, and that only works if, well, what is the case? T1 needs to be a subtype of T2, which would be, for example, valid in that notion when X is an int and Y is a double. So, subtypes can also be expanded to more complex types. Once again, that is not something that you would directly find in your standard C, but there's other languages out there which handle it like that. You could extend the subtype relationship to complex types. So you would carry that over to your struct types. What would that mean? How would you, can you imagine that to be working? Well, for example, in that context, the extract info method would or function would be applicable to all argument structures that return a string field for accessor info. So even if you put a struct in there which has five or six more accessors defined, you would still be able to plug that into your extract info function and be fine with that. So that is a thing when you have subtype relationship on complex types. So if you start thinking in that direction, you're already going a few steps nearer to the idea of objects and classes that you know from, for example, something like Java. For this very basic version of subtyping with complex types, we can just try to refine our method for the type equality to be actually subtyping queries. So we would once again start with queries for the basic things. So if T and T prime are actual basic types, and if T is a subtype of T prime, then we would consider a type query as being fulfilled, as being valid. Then there's the composed ones. For subtyping, it's the same as for just type equality. We would still see this pointer to some other type as being subtypes if the the target types are the same. Then for type defs, it's the same as for type equality. Now, the differences start when you look at the way that these subtyping queries handle structs. So we have two structs for which we want to decide whether one is a sub, whether the left one is a subtype of the right one. So the question is now when we when we wanted to decide precise equality, we were going for having exactly the same structure on both of the types in the, or structs in the query. That now is different for subtyping. Here, it's not actually the case that both of the structs need to still have the same number of accessors. It can now be that the subtype can have more accessors as a supertype. So that is reflected with that thing over here. So the subtype has actually more accessors than the supertype. You can try to help you remember that by illustrating that with this very small example here. So you can always assign a subtype to a supertype. So X need to be assignable to Y, and that is the case if, well, the X must support all the accessors that Y supports, but might support even more. That doesn't have any importance to this assignment. So X is the one that is allowed to have more accessors than Y. So in that sense, J is allowed to be larger than K. Okay, so much for the structs. If we try to carry that over to the functions, then we get, yeah, there's a notion of one function type being a subtype of another function type. But that needs some more branching based on the return type and the parameter types. So this function is a subtype of this function type if the return type is a subtype, and the parameter types are actually supertypes. So that looks a little bit weird at the first point, but in subtyping you get that very special thing. Why is that? That depends on the requirement that for subtyping the subtype needs to be used in the same fashion as the supertype. We'll see that over here. So for the examples, well, here's also the struct example. That was not what I was after. So here's an example where we have two functions, int with parameter int and float with parameter float. Is one of them a subtype of the other? Well, according to the definition that we have seen over there, we would need the return type of one being a subtype of the other's return type, while the parameter type would need to be a supertype. That is not the case for those. And actually, if you would try to, for example, use a function of type int with the parameter of int in a place where you would try to apply a function of parameter float with a return type of float, you would returning an int would not be a problem because the system would expect a float anyway, so an int would be covered by the type of float. However, at the call side for a float with parameter float, you would have to accept floats as parameter, and as you have specified int as your parameter, that would be a no-go. And the same, it would be the other way around, just then the return type would not be applicable. So here for those two, it's actually neither nor, so it's not the case that the left one is a subtype of the right one, and also the right one is not a subtype of the left one. So those are kind of incomparable in the sense of subtyping. However, there's another pair of candidates. There's this int returning float eating function on the left hand side, and there's a float returning integer eating function on the right hand side, and there's actually some type of subtyping going on, which would be you can read that off the return type. So int is a subtype of float. So it would be that way. The parameters would need to be the other way around, and they actually are. So that says that you could use a function of type return type int eating a float in all places where you would expect a function of return type float and parameter int. And well, that's obviously the case. The left function is able to process integers, as it would be even applicable to floats, so integers should not be a problem, and it restricts itself to only return integers, which is pretty fine at all the call sites for functions of that fashion. There, you could even return floats, so that's completely fine. So the left one is actually a subtype of the right one. So in case of functions, you get given that you have a subtype relation between two function definitions, we have covariance on the return types and contravariance on the argument types. Covariance, so your return types follow the same subtyping notion as your functions, and contravariance in that sense that your parameter types do it exactly the other way around as did your function definitions. So, yeah. Good, and that's the solutions to the examples. So, you can use that now to perform subtyping checks on expressions. So we can do that on a few of them that I've set up here. So there's types with type def shortcut names, and all of them are some kind of structs that at some place might carry functions. So let's see whether S1, for example, is a subtype of R2. And we can do that in the same manner as we did for type equality by setting up this deduction tree. And yeah, let's just start from S1, R2. And yeah, first of all, we would probably inline the actual type definitions. For space reasons, I just abbreviate them on the slides and just work on them by keeping them in mind. And yeah, we for these here we need to actually compare the accessors because they are structs, and we can allow for both of these structs to have a different amount of accessors. So let's check. R1 has the accessors A and F, and S1 has the accessors A, B, and F. And in subtyping, remember that we only need to check for the accessors of the supertype. The subtype is allowed to have more accessors than the supertype. So we only need to check for the accessors of the supertype, which is R1, and it has the accessors A and F. Thus, we find the paths A and F emanating from there. A will get us to S1 and R1, so we have int here and int there, which will lead us to, well, syntactically equivalent types. Those are, since the subtyping relation is declared in such a manner that equality is also included, this will terminate our deduction subtree over here. For the other part, where we have to compare for subtyping under the accessor F, we find that both of them have function type. So the first one has function type S1, parameter S1. The second one has R1, parameter R1. So, for those we have to follow the paths of comparing the return types in covariant way. So S1 needs to be a subtype of R1. That is fine. This is the same thing as we have started the whole query with, so we can terminate here. Then we find that for the parameter we need to pursue in contravariant fashion whether there's subtyping going on. So we need to check whether R1 is a subtype of S1. And don't make the mistake and say, well, we have started with S1 being a subtype of R1. We can't R1 being a subtype of S1 is a contradiction by itself. It's not, because we have this notion of not strictness here. So it could still be that R1 and S1 are actually the same types, and then everything would be fine. So we still need to continue. We do so by pursuing now all the accessors of the supertype. And in S1, we have the accessors A, B, and F. And it turns out, well, in R1, we don't have an accessor B, so that's a contradiction. So the whole thing turns out to be invalid. S1 is not a subtype of R1. Good. Next. Is S2 a subtype of S1? So we're comparing. Comparing this one with this one. So can they be considered to be the same ones? Subtype ones? Well, same thing will unroll as before. For S1 is the supertype, so we have to check for all its accessors. So it's first of all A and B. They are present in S1 and S2, and both of them turn out to be the same, so we're fine. So it was this A, B, and this A. So then there remains the accessor F, which leads us to function types, S1 parameters S1 and S2 parameters R2. So we compare them to each other in subtype relation. We first of all check for subtyping of the return types, and well, that is our start assumption. So with this thing, we're done. The parameters have to be subtype checked in contravariant fashion. So R2 goes here and S1 goes here. And we continue on. S1 and R2. So we have to check for the accessors from R2, which has accessor A and F. So we check A, which is int. Wherever we find A, it's int, and the whole thing terminates here. Whereas for F, we have to once again check functions, one with S1 as parameter, and the other one with R2, S2 as parameter in that case. So that is the that is pretty similar to the one that we had over here. It's just the... No, it's not exactly the other one. Okay, so forget that. Sorry. Anyway, we just perform our usual testing in the sense that we compare the return values covariantly and check for S1 being subtype of R2. Which we can find over here already, so that is something that we are currently already checking and can be considered as being checked at that point. And then we also have the contravariant parameters, so S2, S1, which is our assumption, so we can consider that one as also terminated and are done with that test. In this case, we can say, yes, we found that S2 is a structural subtype of S1. And so the whole thing goes on with S2 and R1, and we end up with another true thing over here. Okay. So, you just have to keep in mind that for the space reasons on the slides, I have abbreviated a few of the deductions in there. There have been these pointer two things, which I have collapsed into one node, and I mostly only had the splitting deductions directly represented in these things, but there might have been several steps involved replacing type variables and removing pointer two things and all that. So keep that in mind when you look at these deduction trees. These structural subtypes are something which is quite intriguing. They're quite complex if you take a look at them. It's not so easy to say if you look at them in just their textual representation whether they actually are referring to the same types or not. So that is quite complex to understand and quite a powerful instrument that you have. The practical systems tend to use a more... Well, I don't know whether you could call them more general, but tend to have subtyping in a little bit different form, where you make those subtyping relations explicit by calling them out by their name. You explicitly declare some class as being a superclass of another class or a subclass of another class. So that is what made it to mainstream so far. And the compiler would then try to establish that the type components that you use for declaring these types are actually reflecting the subtyping rules that you the subtyping clauses that you have used for defining their frames. Okay, so apart from that, subtyping for methods is something which is also not so widely seen in languages, although you at least in these mainstream languages, although with this notion of covariance, contravariance, you could do something like that. A little bit of that has made it into mainstream languages. For example, for the return type, I think you can covariantly specialize your type as you overwrite the type of your method in a subclass, for example. But I don't think that the parameter covariance thing has made it into some notion of overwriting in these languages. So, with that, we have completed everything that we needed for the type part of the compiler, and now we would go over to the last topic of code synthesis. But since that is a topic for 1 hour, I think we can leave that for our last lecture and terminate lecture so far here. So thank you, and see you all in a short time in the tutorial or next week.